It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a closer look at the cases the Wisconsin Supreme Court is expected to rule on in the coming weeks.
First, Wisconsin is in the midst of a brain drain, an outflow of young college graduates. While the state's population is increasing a bit, that's largely driven by older residents, and there's a net loss of thousands of 20-something college grads each year.
Our next guest is sounding the alarm about what this could do to Wisconsin's economy, and he's offering some solutions, too. Morris Davis is with us. He's an associate professor of business at UW-Madison and academic director of the James Groskamp Center for Real Estate. Morris, welcome to the show.
Rob, thanks for having me.
So how many of these young college grads are we losing from Wisconsin?
Well, if you add up all the college grads, not just the young ones, we've been losing 14,000 per year. So over the past 5 years, we've lost 70,000 college graduates to other states.
And mostly young ones, or a lot of people are focusing on the people in that 20-something age range?
Yes. Of that 14,000, 8,000 or 9,000 have been under the age of 30.
Why is this a worry for the state's economy?
Well, there's two reasons to worry. One is we have social programs that we have to fund. And as the population gets older, we need taxpayers to fund those programs. So we're losing highly educated, highly compensated workforce that will be a net drain on the taxes for those that remain will have to go up. And the second is the assembly, the legislature has made it a priority to create jobs. Mm-hmm. Retirees don't create jobs, so we need inflows of young people to create jobs. And rather than having inflows of young people, we're having outflows of young people.
And I was looking at some of your charts earlier. I saw numbers like, you know, if this trend continues, annual job creation numbers of 6, like a single-digit job creation number.
Yeah, you know, so we're exiting a recession now, or we were until the first quarter. And when you exit a recession, people that were looking for work gain work. So you'd figure job growth would be high because we're exiting a recession. However, our population's aging. So some people that have jobs are going to be retiring. So if you net those forces together, basically without any inflows at all, the people entering the workforce because the economy is recovering will almost exactly equal people leaving the workforce because they're aging. So the only way that we can have job growth is to have inflows of people either from foreign countries or from other states. And we do not have a good track record of attracting on net people from other states. So I think a very realistic forecast for job growth for 2014-2015 in Wisconsin is a number like 0. I mean, my modal forecast, the forecast I'd expect would be, it's not a 0, but it's a number like 15,000 jobs per year. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very low number, and it's indicative of the kinds of demographic problems that Wisconsin has.
Well, let's look at these 20-something college grads. Why are they leaving Wisconsin if they're leaving Wisconsin, and why aren't the other ones from the other states coming to Wisconsin?
That's a very hard question to answer. You know, we can look at the states that seem to be doing the right things and compare them to states that seem to be doing the wrong things, and Wisconsin's somewhere in the middle. So, we all love to compare ourselves to Minnesota. Minnesota basically has a stable population, in contrast to Wisconsin, which does not. And Minnesota's attracting high-skill labor, college graduates, young college graduates, and they're actually losing lower-skill labor, just high school graduates. I know that's not really a great definition of low skill, but that's the data we have access to. So their mix is changing to high skill from low skill, and their population is stable. Wisconsin's sort of the other way. We're losing college graduates. We're losing population. The population that is coming in tends to have just a high school degree. So I think we could look at Minnesota and ask what they're doing. But the state that's attracting everyone is Texas. Texas is gaining 170,000 people a year from other states. And I think we could ask, what is Texas doing that we're not doing, and try to emulate that?
I mean, is it just a matter of being warmer? It's something we don't have control over?
We don't have control of the temperature, but neither does Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin does not have a good business. I know. No one's going to like hearing this, but I'll say it anyway. Wisconsin does not have a good business climate, and we don't have a great major city. It's not like young people are going to be very attracted to move to Milwaukee as compared to, say, Chicago or Minneapolis. I think that's a problem for the state. We're also a high tax. No one will like me saying this, but I'll say it again. We're a high tax state. You could also say we're a high benefit state. I don't know if that's true or not. Texas is a low tax state. They've got Dallas and Houston. I never thought that those were two great cities, but apparently people like them. They've also got Austin and San Antonio. And whatever they're doing there, they're attracting 150,000 people per year.
Well, is this a chicken or egg question? Maybe those places have jobs that are hiring lots of college graduates. That's where the college graduates are going. The current job situation is creating this migration of the young, educated people?
You know, I don't know. I know exactly what you're asking. We could say, did Wisconsin start out with the wrong skill base? You know, if you look, we're not creating manufacturing jobs. Manufacturing's not going to, there might be a minor revitalization of manufacturing, but there's no way you'd say manufacturing is the future of the U.S. That would just not align with what history suggests. History suggests we're a high-tech, high-skill economy. Therefore, we should focus on biotech, high-skill, high-tech jobs. Those jobs are created in Massachusetts, New York, California, Texas. You know, they're not being created in Wisconsin. So I think our industrial mix didn't give us a good leg to start on them, but it doesn't mean it's a permanent thing. It just means we have to start thinking about how to change it.
Well,
just to add one more thought, we're not the worst, the state in the worst shape of the union is Michigan. Michigan is losing, I think, 80,000 people per year. So every 3 years, a city the size of Madison leaving Michigan. So, you know, just for perspective, mm-hmm. Wisconsin's problems are not nearly as severe as Michigan's, but I think the reasons for the problems are similar.
Well, let's get into solutions a little bit now. You've got ideas for what the state can do, what our higher education system can do to start trying to keep the college graduates here and lure others in. Let's start with that keeping Wisconsin graduates in Wisconsin. What could we do?
Well, we do have a good record. So I think there's some confusion about this is a lot of the college graduates we train, we keep. Mm-hmm. I think the number's between 85 and 90%. You know, so the question is, where are the other 10% going and why? That's of people that graduate from Wisconsin institutions. So the any plan I would recommend wouldn't be so much about focusing on the other 10% that we're losing as trying to attract college graduates from other states to move in. I think actually that's an easy sell because college graduates oftentimes leave college with a lot of debt. So I think with the right financial incentives for at the person level and not the corporate level, we could attract quite a lot of people to the state. And you know, so for example, we could anyone with a certain degree, with a good credit score, with the right kind of training at the right university, we could offer them, say, $20,000 to move to the state as a loan that's forgiven if they're here for 5 years. And they'd have to pay taxes for 5 years. But then after 5 years, then it'd be forgiven. My suspicion is that program would be very, very successful. What college graduate wouldn't want $20,000 to help pay off their student debt? Then, you know, you can guess what they'd earn once they're here. You can guess how much they'd spend. So if you count the income taxes they pay once they're here and you count the sales taxes they pay on the things that they buy, that program basically pays for itself after 5 years. So it looks like it has an expensive price tag. I mean, 10,000 people looks like it costs $200 million. But if you have the long view, if you think about the taxes accruing over a five-year period, the net cost to the state is zero. But I understand it. $200 million to kids graduating college for 10,000 students, it just seems like a big number, but it'll work. So that's just one idea that's floating out there. I'm sure there are other ideas, but it is a little disappointing to say, I know the state's great. I love it here. And it's sort of disappointing to say, oh yeah, if we want more people in the state, we have to pay them.
We have to bribe them.
They do that with doctors though all the time. Mm-hmm. So I'm just advocating that the level be shifted from not just doctors, but also from high skill, high demanded younger folks.
We're talking to Morris Davis of the UW-Madison about brain drain, an outflow, a net outflow of young college grads from the state and what it means for the future of our economy. And you can join the conversation. Do you see brain drain as a problem in your part of the state? What, if anything, could be done about it? And are you a fairly recent college graduate? Why are you staying in Wisconsin, or why are you planning to leave? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about the impact of brain drain here in Wisconsin. Young, well-educated people either leaving the state or, if they're from elsewhere, not moving here. We're checking out why this is a problem and some possible solutions with Morris Davis. He's business professor at UW-Madison. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're a recent graduate, tell your story, why you stayed, why you're going. If you're from out of state, tell us about that too. By the way, a related topic coming up tomorrow at this time, we'll check out efforts in Door County to lure more millennial-age tourists, workers, and residents there. And Morris, I wanted to ask you about that. We talked a little bit. We'll talk more probably about what we can do at the state level. Are there things local communities can do to try to stem their own brain drain?
That's a very difficult question. People are free to move, so I think, you know, communities have to focus on providing the kind of amenities that young people and educated people want. But those things are expensive, and oftentimes they're subsidized by state taxes. So I do think it's a state problem. Obviously, you know, people like Madison, people like Milwaukee, some people like Milwaukee. I think Green Bay, you know, it's possible that I've been told Kenosha is trying to do these things. It's possible, but I do think we need action at the state level because that's where, frankly, most of the government dollars are located.
And you mentioned people seeking maybe a high-tech community with lots of jobs. I mean, could Madison become that if Milwaukee isn't? You've got a lot of jobs with Epic here and spin-off businesses from that, and the university, of course.
I think Madison could. You know, we're talking, you know, if I had my druthers, I'd say we should target a number like 30 to 50,000 people a year for about 5 years. And then after that, just take a pause and see what happened. And certainly Madison could handle that. I do think that if you were to take a random person, college person from out of the state and ask, you know, where would you want to live, knowing nothing about the state of Wisconsin, most would probably say either Madison or Milwaukee. And then in terms of the job creation, I think employers will create jobs where these clusters of really highly skilled young people are. So even if we don't have the right industrial mix right now in Milwaukee, as these young kids arrive with $20,000 in their pocket, some of them will start businesses and others of them will, people will create jobs for them.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Mikkel in La Crosse. Mikkel, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I graduated a four-year apprenticeship in 2011. Through a non-union affiliation, ABC Associated Builders and Contractors. And they gave me a certification which keeps me in the construction field as a journeyman roofer and waterproofer. And I've decided to stay in the state because of the amount of work that's available for the construction field in general, from the southern parts of the states to the east to the west, from La Crosse to Green Bay to Madison to Milwaukee to Eau Claire to Superior. I got very well-paid jobs offered to me all year long, and it's one of the main reasons I stick around. One of the other reasons would be the fact that I take great pride in this is the state I'm from. Mm-hmm. This is where my children were born, and I want to be a part of growing the community and building these commercial and residential projects. So I see a great future for the state, and I hope that everybody gets to experience the growth as we build.
Mikkel, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story. He's coming from the skilled trade side of things there, Morris. Is that something you're looking at in your research or mainly just college grads?
Mainly just college grads. Obviously, it's a very rough cut at what skill means. Most economists say either 4 years of college or just a high school degree. Obviously, skill means different things to different people. But on average, people with college degrees earn more than people with just high school degrees. And we use those higher earnings of college graduates to pay for social programs. So,
He brought up a point, there's the money and the jobs, but there's also attachment to community. Is there, I know that's maybe a tough thing to put a number on or a state policy on, but is there something that the state can do, that businesses can do to facilitate that kind of personal attachment and connection?
You know, that attachment shows up in the data. Most the probability a given person moves across state, once you're 35 or 40, the probability that you just pick up and move across the state is 2%. So really, the people that move are the ones that are unattached, and they tend to be young and college educated. Say young being under 35 and college educated. So that's why I think any program that tries to bring people in should focus on that group. And that's why, but you know, correspondingly, we should focus on keeping that group because they're most likely to leave. I think the same kinds of things that will bring people in, you know, if we bring in 50,000 people a year to Milwaukee that are all young, highly educated with $20,000 in their pocket, Milwaukee is going to be a really nice place in 5 years. And that will keep all the other young, highly educated people that moved to Milwaukee there. So I think these kinds of programs could have big benefits.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Gail on the line in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of my major clients is in does search for corporations. We find high-end talent for companies nationally and internationally. And what we have found over the last 10, 20 years is there's a gravitation, and over the years, more people are looking for, especially the younger people, are looking for technical-based jobs. And there's kind of a challenge because with the jobs that are out there, if their degrees aren't applicable to any particular type of honing in on a specialty, they really have a hard time taking that degree and applying it to a job. And I think that's part of the issue that a lot of the younger kids are having is they have these degrees. And with Texas having Texas Instruments and major corporations for airlines and that, there's a lot of extra jobs in those areas, and they're not seasonal. And I think with Wisconsin being a seasonal recreational state, I think do you agree maybe that that's one of the issues is we're having this fluctuation happening of what our state really is now?
Gail, interesting points. Morris.
Yeah, no, this is the chicken and egg problem. We don't have any high skill. We have plenty of high skill, but let's say we don't have that many high skill folks here, so there aren't going to be that many employers coming in creating high skill jobs. So I think it has to start somewhere. You either have to pay companies to just come in and post vacancies that are the kinds of vacancies that we want here, or we have to pay people with these kinds of skills to come here and hope that employers, recognizing the new depth of the talent pool, will start making those kinds of jobs available. But that has to start somewhere. And I guess we've tried from the tax credit side to encourage employers. Maybe it's been more manufacturing than anything else, but think of that as the demand side of labor. And I think we should focus now policies on the supply side of labor. How do we get people to move here so that employers have someone to hire if they want to hire?
But again, am I going to pack up and move as a 20-something, maybe with a tech, high-tech computer science, biotech degree, if there's nobody there to hire me?
That's a tough question. I mean, the gamble, policy requires some uncertainty. I think if you want to make a big move, there's always some uncertainty. But I think if you're going to offer somebody $20,000, I think they'll take that chance. I mean, worst case scenario, they could start their own business. I say worst case, maybe in their own mind. Mm-hmm. But there are jobs, there are plenty of jobs here. The question is, is the fit exactly perfect? And, probably not right now, but maybe young graduates would be willing to overlook that for a $20,000 grant or loan, depending on how it's structured.
Well, you mentioned the policy side of things. Are state legislators the ones who ultimately would have to decide things like that? Or the university, are people starting to take this seriously to where they're ready to think big and do something like what you're talking about?
I've heard through the grapevine that we're now aware of the problem. And so I think people are willing to think big. nobody likes to admit you have a problem. It's a lovely state, and there are a lot of great people here, and there's a lot of pride in the state. So it's really a little embarrassing to say we have to pay people to move in. I mean, one way to think about what Texas does, Texas pays people to move in. How? There's no income tax. You can think of that as basically letting them keep a higher fraction of their salary than if they were to move to a place like New Jersey or New York, where 8% of their income goes to the state. So, you know, we have to compete in that environment. Maybe we have to pay people to move in. And I think my understanding is the legislators are willing to consider these things. And I would not be surprised to see some proposals out there in the fall.
We'll leave it there for now and watch for those. Morris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rob.
That was Morris Davis. He's Associate Professor of Business at UW-Madison and Academic Director of the James Groskamp Center for Real Estate.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Wisconsin's legislature voted in March to create a state-appointed mental health board in Milwaukee. Governor Walker made his final two appointments to that board last Friday. We'll look at what's next for Milwaukee's current dysfunctional system.
First, we've seen a number of high-profile rulings from the United States Supreme Court over the last week or so. And while their business is now done for the term, Wisconsin Supreme Court is gearing up to release some big rulings of their own.
Over the next few weeks, the court will be issuing rulings on Act 10, voter ID, and same-sex partnership benefits, just to name a few. All eyes will be on the justices as they have the final say on some of the biggest legal battles of the last few years.
Joining us now to talk about the cases being considered is Patrick Marley. He's the Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of More Than They Bargained For with fellow Journal Sentinel reporter Jason Stein. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So the Wisconsin Supreme Court has a lot on their plate this term. They're a little bit slower than the Supreme Court at the federal level. And you're expecting decisions to be coming out over the next several weeks. But how big are some of these lingering decisions left on the plate there?
Well, you mentioned the three most important ones that they have left to decide. That's Act 10, the labor limits that Governor Walker put in place in 2011. That's been challenged by some unions. Voter ID, they've got two cases on voter ID that they're considering. And then they've got the same-sex partnership law that Democrats passed in 2009. After the state banned gay marriage, they created a registry that couples could get some of the benefits of marriage if they registered at counties, and that's been challenged as violating the state's ban on gay marriage.
Well, I want to start with the Act 10 case. We've seen some legal ping-pong on this, challenges to Governor Walker's signature piece of legislation. What is the court looking at here? What remains?
So Act 10 has been faced a lot of legal challenges. It was passed in 2011. It largely eliminated collective bargaining for most public employees in the state. It was challenged twice in federal court, and both times the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals upheld it. Act 10 was also challenged in state court on a theory that lawmakers had violated the open meetings law in passing it. The state Supreme Court rejected that a few months after the law was passed and allowed it to go into place. Another challenge, the one that's pending now, was filed in state court on the argument that Act 10 violated workers' constitutional rights to free assembly and equal protection under the law, saying that union workers were treated worse than employees who did not choose to be in a union. A Dane County judge agreed with them in 2012 and said that key parts of Act 10 violated the state constitution. That has now worked its way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will decide whether Act 10 can continue as it is or if it's in violation of the Constitution.
Do you have any sense of the outlook here? Largely, Act 10 has been upheld, except for this piece, which is moving up the courts. What are you expecting?
Well, the court gave a little bit of a clue earlier because in this litigation became quite complex because the judge had ruled in favor of the unions, and this question was created as to whether the ruling applied just to the unions who had sued or to all unions in the state, and the state's Employment Relations Board continued to apply Act 10 to other unions, and another union intervened and said to the judge, these board members are in contempt of court because they're applying Act 10 after you've declared it unconstitutional. And the judge did issue contempt charges against Governor Walker's appointees to the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission. That issue came up to the Supreme Court along with the underlying case, and within 10 days of the court hearing oral arguments, it issued a 5-2 decision undoing the contempt of court order and allowing the Employment Relations Commission to sort of continue doing how it had been interpreting Act 10 for other unions. So that perhaps gives us a sign of where the court is leaning on the merits of the case, though they haven't actually addressed the merits yet.
Well, so should the court rule against Act 10, would it be possible that collective bargaining would be reinstated broadly?
If it would be a very big win for the unions if they were to win before the Supreme Court. They would get many things back, but they would not get as much back as they had before Act 10 was put in place. There are elements of Act 10 that would still be in place. I think there would be a lot of questions as to how, I mean, we're going to have to see what the court does. If the unions do succeed before the court, I would not be surprised to see other litigation, either from unions trying to gain more or from opponents or supporters of Act 10 who would want to limit whatever the Supreme Court might do.
Well, we're going to move on now to another big issue. This involves the voter ID law, which has also seen lots of legal back and forth over the past few years. The newest wrinkle here involved a federal judge's recent ruling about the state's ID requirement. What do we expect here on that front?
So this is very complex because of the competing litigation, so to speak. The state passed in 2011 a voter ID law requiring people to show ID at the polls, and four lawsuits followed, two in federal court, two in state court. And as you mentioned, the federal judge recently ruled that it violated the U.S. Constitution. And so that is being appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Voter ID cannot be in place unless and until the appeals court or the U.S. Supreme Court were to overrule it. Meanwhile, we've got this these state challenges with two Dane County judges in separate litigation ruling that it violated two different aspects of the state constitution. One of those was reversed on appeal, but the other one remained in place, and those are before the state Supreme Court. So if the state Supreme Court were to say that voter ID was okay under the state constitution, that would be a win for Governor Walker and other supporters of voter ID laws, but it would not put the law back in place because of the judge's ruling in the federal case. In short, supporters of voter ID would have to win all four cases. If they lose any one of the four, then they don't get voter ID.
So the likelihood that this would be in place by the November elections, that's looking difficult right now.
That is diminishingly small because at the pace at which the federal court is going to move, it would be highly unlikely that they would rule before November. So I think that, it's hard to say never, especially in state politics in Wisconsin in the last few years, but it seems very, very unlikely that it would be in place for the November 2014 elections.
Another thing on the Supreme Court's docket, looking at a case involving benefits for same-sex partnerships. What's at stake there?
So this one is also a twist in this is separate federal litigation recently. U.S. District Judge Barbara Crabb ruled that the state's ban on gay marriage violated the U.S. Constitution, and that ruling's been stayed, but her underlying finding is in place that gay couples could get wed. So if you can set that aside for a minute, what happened is in 2006, voters changed the state constitution to ban gay marriage and to ban civil unions, or what the way it's phrased in the Constitution, to ban any relationship substantially similar to marriage for same-sex couples. A few years after that, Democrats controlled all of state government, and they included a provision in the state budget that allowed same-sex couples to register at a county and then acquire some but not all of the benefits of marriage. They could get, like, hospital visitation rights, for instance. And the head of Wisconsin Family Action, which was one of the main forces lobbying for the gay marriage ban, challenged that in court, saying that the domestic partnership registries violated the state's ban on gay marriage and substantially similar relationships. That argument failed in county court in Dane County and before the appeals court, and now the state Supreme Court is reviewing it. We'll see what they have to say.
All right, and we're going to cover one last thing here before we go. The court also has a few cases in front of it that have to do with the John Doe investigation of Governor Walker. Now, this is not something that the Supreme Court in Wisconsin needs to wrap up in the next few weeks, but what is expected there?
So the court finishes its work on June 30th, which was yesterday, and that's sort of for their normal term. They take cases throughout the year, and then they try to finish them on June 30th, and then they sort of dribble them out over the next few weeks after that. And today, the Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson released a statement saying that the court had in fact finished all its work, and in the next several weeks would be issuing its decisions. But the court all the time has cases come to it that it has to decide whether to take or not to take, and three of those cases are related to the John Doe investigation of Governor Walker. The court hasn't said what it's going to do, and we don't know when it will say that, but it's sort of not on the usual timeline of other cases, so the court could act this afternoon, or the court could act 3 months from now or 6 months from now in deciding whether to even take the cases.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that and all the rest of it. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
We've been talking to Patrick Marley, Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of More Than They Bargained For with fellow Journal Sentinel reporter Jason Stein.
This past March, Wisconsin's legislature voted almost unanimously to remove control of the Milwaukee County Mental Health System from the county board. The new legislation instead called for the creation of a state-appointed board of medical professionals and others to run the system.
The decision came after decades of reports of dysfunction in the system, including sexual assaults, deaths, and an inability to create long-term treatment programs for patients.
Last Friday, Governor Walker named the final two members of the new 13-member Milwaukee Mental Health Board. He missed the June 9th deadline to name those appointees. Joining us now is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Health and Welfare investigative reporter Meg Kissinger. She led the paper's investigation of the mental health care system there that led to this ongoing overhaul. Meg, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
So Governor Walker's deadline on these appointees was earlier this month. He hit those a little late. Did he give reasons for that delay?
He didn't. He actually kind of took umbrage at my even asking about that and said that he had named a quorum. It was sufficient for a quorum. But some in the mental health community saw it as a little bit of an affront. You know, there's a lot of excitement and expectation and hope riding on a board that is staffed with medical professionals and people with lived experience. And the expectation was that, it would be launched with a little fanfare and not just dribbled out.
And do we have a sense of the direction that the state's trying to move the system by looking at who those 13 appointees are?
Well, they come by way of nominations. So these weren't folks that the governor just capriciously chose. They are people who are on a list submitted to him from both County Executive Chris Abley, who had four nominations of four of the 13 board members, and then a county board that had five. And then the remaining numbers came from dedicated spots by various groups, including the Medical College of Wisconsin and the Mental Health Task Force. And so so these were people, everybody on that list is somebody well-known in the mental health community in Milwaukee.
As you described last time you were on, this board has its work cut out for it. A lot of problems in the mental health system. Everybody pretty much seems to agree with that. What is success for this new board down the road?
So that's a great question. I think that success looks like real and substantive change and not the same old, same old. And, as we have reported time and again, 30 years or more of lip service, really, to improving conditions for people with mental illness and, promises unkept. And as we wait for changes in that, the clunky old structure of Milwaukee County's mental health system, groans on and chewing up, within, our patients really suffering. And conditions at the complex have deteriorated. Years ago, they gave up accreditation, et cetera. We've, documented all along the failures. And so there's just, a lot of hope. And So success, for my way of thinking, looks at substantive change, and in particular, moving it away from this very institutionalized structure relying on an institution to mental health in the community.
And again, as you described last time, the priority over the last few decades has been hospitalization, in effect, institutionalization of people with mental illness. The move, the priority, it sounds like, is to go to more community treatment programs, community residential programs. Is that a priority for this new board?
Yes. And you know, that has been a problem everywhere, really. You know, we can't claim sole ownership of that awful situation, because universally across the United States, you know, this, when institutions began to shut down, and a lot for very good reasons, the promise was that care would be delivered at mental health centers based in neighborhoods, and that just didn't happen. Those weren't built, and for a lot of reasons. And so, so that is where the focus will be now. And, you know, a lot of things are happening concurrent to that. So just today begins, you know, mental health parity nationally. And so, you know, as a part of the Affordable Care Act, the promise is, you know, health care for all, regardless of the ability to buy insurance, and that includes mental health conditions.
There's been some controversy from the labor angle on this, moving away from that mental health complex, unionized jobs. The legislators behind the legislation we're talking about say it would allow outsourcing, going away from union jobs. What's the current state of affairs on that?
Right. I think that this is a situation that doesn't fit into a very tight box on that question. So, in other words, you know, the labor unions that work very hard to keep jobs for their members, you know, have a vested interest in both keeping the hospitals running, but, you know, no one is too cynical, or I hope not, that unions are just fighting back, you know, pushing back on closing the hospital for the sake of saving jobs, because certainly there are jobs, good jobs to be had, you know, in the community. And so, you know, the motivations I want to believe are not altogether selfish on either side, you know, or shouldn't be. I mean, the central question should always be what is the best for the health, you know, the mental health of patients.
And union members have raised safety concerns. If the complex, the mental health complex, is closed or downsized too quickly, you don't have enough staff to deal with the patients who are still there.
Right. And you know, I think that is a very important role for them to play, to ask the hard questions. Okay, we have, so for example, at the mental health complex in Milwaukee County, we have long-term care units. And just to understand, you know, so that your listeners know, I mean, these are not people who are going through mild depression, not to minimize the effects of mild depression, but we are talking about people with very deep-rooted and wide-ranging disabilities that need great structure. And so you can't simply say, okay, we're downsizing and good luck out in the community. There needs to be a guarantees, you know, that people are being placed in settings, in homes that have that can be scrutinized and inspected, and we can and society can check their well-being.
As this change happens, who pays for it, and is it going to be more or less expensive from what we know now?
Well, those,
huge question, I know.
Yeah, right. Who pays for it? A lot. You and I, both in terms of county dollars, state dollars, federal dollars, and then, you know, for people that have private insurance, which almost nobody in the population that we're talking about, you know, people with real profound both developmental and mental health worries or issues, they are not going to have most likely private insurance. So, yeah, it's public dollars that we're talking about.
And briefly, I've heard there might be a shortage of key professionals, maybe psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and others to ease this transition to community care and treatment. Is that true?
Yeah,
is that a problem?
That is the next big story in mental health. So as we transition, you know, from this institutional care into the community, what good is it going to do us if we don't have the doctors to supply the care? And, you know, as is well documented, child psychiatrists, that is the number one shortage in medicine today, are child psychiatrists. There is not a child psychiatrist north of Wausau in the state of Wisconsin. So you can have all the clamor, you know, can have the great demand for care, but if you don't have the supply, we're in big trouble.
We'll leave it there for now, but probably check in with you again on this, I imagine. Meg, thanks for joining us.
Please do. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter Meg Kissinger, talking about the progress in creating Milwaukee's new mental health board. She reported and continues to report the Chronic Crisis series, which led to this major overhaul.